I call the committee to order. Welcome, everyone. This is the Wednesday, January 14th, 2015 meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. Today is simply an overview hearing. We are going to hear from the Department of Transportation on two reports. One we've already heard in front of this committee, but it's a new year, and it's worthwhile refreshing ourselves on the work that has been done examining the role of freight rail as an aspect of our economy, taking a look at the role that freight rail plays in Minnesota and how we might better understand that role and some of the things we might undertake to help support the role of freight rail. And then as a function of legislation that we passed last year relating to the issue of freight rail congestion and freight rail safety and concerns that have been emerging over the past couple of years, particularly with the emergence of the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota, we asked MnDOT to take a look at crossings at grade and grade-separated crossings throughout the state and figure out what exactly is going on and where we might focus our resources in addressing freight rail crossings throughout the state of Minnesota. And so we have a report on that subject that was just recently turned in, and so we're anxiously waiting to hear more about that. I will mention that Senator Disick has joined us. Welcome to the Transportation Committee, Senator Disick. Senator Disick has a lot of freight in her district, and a lot of freight up on bridges, and has been focusing a lot of her time and attention on this. So we're glad you're here. With that, I'll invite MnDOT to the table and let them introduce themselves and proceed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Dibble, my name is Bill Gardner. I'm director of the Freight and Rail Office at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And today we'd like to tell you about the results of two different rail studies, as the chair mentioned. I'm joined today by Dave Christensen, who heads up our rail planning activities. The first study provides recommendations on improving safety at grade crossings on rail corridors that transport crude oil. The second study focuses on identifying strategies to use rail shipping essentially as a catalyst for economic development, and we conducted that study in cooperation with DEED, the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Together, the results of the studies can be used to increase both the efficiency as well as the safety of the freight rail system in Minnesota. As you'll hear from Dave in his presentation, Minnesota is very much a railroad state. We have a number of industries and numerous businesses that rely on shipping as a rail shipping as a cost-effective transportation option. That reliance, though, can be a double-edged sword. As at the same time that it supports job growth and economic development, it can introduce certain risks, particularly in the areas of safety and impacts on communities. Our goal is to maximize the benefits of rail and minimize the risks. We'll provide some overall background on the history of rail in Minnesota, its current structure, the regulatory framework, some current trends and issues, and then present the specific findings of the two studies that I referenced. Feel free to interrupt Dave during his presentation with any questions that you have, or you can wait with your questions until afterwards, and we'll do the best we can to answer those questions. So at this point, I'll turn it over to David.
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if there is no opposition, we'll swap the agenda. It's logically, it's a little bit easier to present about the overview of rail in Minnesota and what's happening with the current level of traffic, particularly crude oil, agriculture, and material, and then get into the freight and economic development report. As Bill said, Minnesota is very much a railroad state. We have 4,500 miles of track. At one point in time, we had 10,000 miles of track in the state back before 1980. The deregulation in 1980 allowed the railroads to merge and to get rid of redundant trackage, but they're still moving more tonnage today than they ever have. Minnesota carries about 38% of all the freight and ton miles produced in the state by rail. That's opposed to 16% average for state in the U.S. And we're projecting that by 2030 we'll have up to a 40% growth in that rail traffic, everything from bulk materials and crude oil to containerized traffic. A little bit of history behind the state. We had our first train operating the state in St. Paul headed north in 1862. The Interstate Commerce Act was approved by Congress in 1887, which brought federal regulation across the board on all activities of the railroad. In 1929, the railroads in the state reached their peak, 9,400 miles. Literally every community of any size in the state had a railroad branch and passenger rail service because there were no other options at the time. In 1971, passenger rail had given way to long-distance travel by airplane and short-distance travel by automobile and bus, and Amtrak took over the passenger service in the country, literally cutting out 9/10 of all the passenger rail miles that were there and leaving us with a background transcontinental service. In 1980, as I mentioned, Stagger's Rail Act was enacted by Congress. Congress had a very important decision to make at that point in time. A third of the railroad industry was bankrupt, and we were having derailments, fires, catastrophic incidents, and service failures all across the country because of the lack of profitability of the railroads and the fact that under the federal government's micromanagement, they faced the decision of either nationalizing the railroad system, which they'd already done with Conrail in the entire Northeast, or deregulate it and let it reach its own equilibrium. They chose the deregulation route along with other modes of transportation. In 1995, the Congress, because of issues with local control and deregulated activities of the railroad, decided to reinstitute some of the Interstate Commerce Commission's powers under the Federal Surface Transportation Board, and that is what we continue with today. That regulation compared to the old ICC, though, is extremely limited. For instance, contract service and agricultural products are not regulated in terms of rates and service, although normal carload business is. In 2012, we recorded the highest amount of rail tonnage ever moved in the state of Minnesota, and 2015 may be another record year. 2014 is on track to equal 2012, and we see a continued increase. That exceeds even the tonnage that was moved in World War II. Starting with 1980, the railroad started to return to profitability. It was a long-term process, almost 30 years, to get in shape. Last year, every Class I railroad, including the two Canadian carriers in the United States, reached the SEC's measure of sustainability, which was to generate enough profits to reinvest in all of their capital needs and still book a profit for their shareholders. First time in recorded history since the ICC Act was instituted back in the 1890s. The system was rationalized down from 60 major railroads down to 7. Track miles were cut in half, but tonnage continued to grow. And service levels and speed and velocity of the system continued to grow. They did that mainly through one major technical achievement, and that is the use of unit trains. Starting in the late 1970s and 80s, coal started moving in unit trains. With that, they could cut their costs in half and just literally move a 100-car train in a shuttle service from origin to destination, returning empty and then moving again. That tripled the utilization of single carload lots and, of course, made the railroads much more profitable. They continued this with grain shuttles that were instituted in the 1990s. It allowed the railroads to, with only half of their fleet, ship three times as much grain. In the Dakotas and Minnesota in particular, it allowed most of the co-ops and the grain exporters to reduce their transportation costs by 30%. So it wasn't just a win for the railroads, it was a win for all of industry. Double stack containers started moving in unit trains beginning in the middle 1980s, and of course crude oil out of the Bakken, for lack of pipelines, started moving full pipeline lots in unit trains out of the Bakken. I'll speak a little bit more about that. And then, of course, the short lines on all the branches that were unsustainable or couldn't be operated in a union environment or with conventional rail service. A whole bunch of branches were sold off to short lines and grew up. We now have 17 short lines in Minnesota. There was only a handful in 1980. Most of those are profitable, although with very thin profit margins. And they, you know, in many communities are the face of railroading and the face of customer service. As you can see on this chart, the Bakken oil industry in particular in North Dakota, also some in Oklahoma and Texas, saw a huge revolution in the movement of hazardous materials and crude oil by rail. If you look back to 2005 and 2006, the start of the Bakken oil field, they were moving a few thousand carloads. There was literally a 100% increase by 2013 in the amount of crude moving by rail. And those are all moving in unit trains. The Bakken itself accounts for about 25% of the shale oil being produced in the U.S. and over half of the rail mileage that is produced, with a light sweet crude, highly volatile, but also extremely valuable in terms of automotive fuels. Half of the barrel can be converted with very little refining to gasoline and diesel and jet fuel. So we now have a new traffic flow through the state that we've never seen in our history before. A little word about the rail regulatory structure, because the question always comes up, what can we do as a state? What do we need to do in cooperation with the federal government? Interstate commerce by the U.S. Constitution is reserved to the U.S. government. That said, anything that they choose not to act on devolves again to the states. For instance, in the area of interstate commerce and rail safety, it's all handled by the Federal Railroad Administration. Rates and services are regulated by the federal government. Any issues that inhibit interstate commerce are automatically taken up by the federal government and the federal courts. Back in the 1860s, as part of the fact that the rail network for a time was the only means of long-distance transportation and now a very necessary part of the transportation system, railroads were given an eminent domain by Congress. They still reserve that right to take property, private property, but cannot exercise that eminent domain against public properties. They have common carrier status. Now, this is extremely important for us as a state. Common carrier status says that any common carrier, whether it be truck, barge operator, airline, or railroad, has to receive and move any cargo tendered to them by the public or private industry without question, without extra handling requirements, indemnification, or any other restrictions. This is what allowed the Bakken oil producers to continue growing the oil field out there when they ran out of pipeline space. They could go to the railroads and say, here's a tank car load of oil, carry it for me to Philadelphia. Railroads were required to do that. We face the problem on a daily basis where the railroads try to demarket some of their services, and we, even as MnDOT, and on behalf of state industry in front of the STB, stand in and make written complaints and verbal complaints about the railroads not living up to their common carrier responsibility. And usually under the STB, there is a resolution negotiated and not ruled by action of the STB, which can happen. Local police powers still apply. Any railroad is a citizen of the jurisdiction that they're in. So if it's property zoning, planning, traffic congestion, hours of operation under curfew, anything of that sort, they have to abide by those local rules. That said, if it inhibits interstate commerce, for instance, a requirement to do extra environmental evaluation of something that is on the railroad right-of-way, the federal government gives railroads a categorical exclusion against major environmental impact reports. Local government cannot impose that upon them, although many have tried. And then, of course, the state of Minnesota, again, by federal absence of regulation and by our own statutory responsibilities, manages all road crossing safety measures in the state at all levels of road authority. We partner in federal programs for track inspection and safety and funding of rail development projects. And we also administer and distribute grants and loans such as Tiger Grants for the state when it comes from the FRA. The Federal Railroad Administration, the triumvirate that regulates railroads in the U.S., takes care of mainly safety issues. They also do the funding and oversight of Amtrak. The Surface Transportation Board, as I said, looks at regulatory issues having to do with rates, service, and also abandonments and mergers. And then the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, which has been in the headlines very frequently in the last year, takes care of hazardous materials and any packaging having to do with handling those hazardous materials. In other words, new pipeline regulations, which are due out tomorrow, by the way, by federal law, are under the auspices of PHMSA with advice from FRA. So when we're talking about safer tank cars, this is the agency that has to rule on that. Freight rail issues right now, of course, I mentioned rail safety. We have hazardous materials issues. Before Bakken crude, our largest hazardous commodity was ethanol. About one unit train a day originating from our 20 ethanol factories around the country and going anywhere in the country. A lot of those come off of short lines. Looking at what we do with Bakken today, 7 train loads of Bakken coming across the state every day. So ethanol pales in comparison to that. Before ethanol, we had a few carloads, literally, of things like chlorine and anhydrous ammonia moving across the state various parts of the year. But a very, very small percentage, a fraction of 1% of all traffic. Rail capacity and reliability last year reached a threshold where we saw rail failures happening for the first time in 30 years. We had a combination of 2 bumper crops of grain harvests. We had the Bakken oil boom. We had iron ore resurging. We had coal, which wasn't supposed to ever come back again, resurged to pre-recession levels. And then, of course, we had just the polar vortex, which slowed everything down. The issue with cold weather and railroad operation is that below 10 degrees below zero, the grommets on the air hoses that operate the brakes on the railroad line start to harden, air starts to leak, the brakes begin to set. The trains have to be run shorter with more horsepower. That means that more crews are required. That weather condition was the straw that broke the camel's back. They'd already been slowing down in service levels and velocity. When that happened, the whole railroad system, not only here but in Chicago and across the northern tier of states, completely collapsed. And then we have community impacts that we'll talk about a little bit later. Block crossings, the grade crossings, lack of emergency access, noise, vibration, horn soundings where communities want quiet zones but are constantly, people are kept awake by horns blowing all night long where there's frequent train traffic. All of these are issues that we've seen come to the fore this last year. Bakken shale oil and gas. The first commercial well was proven as far as the technology went for deep shale oil drilling in 2000.
So, Mr. Christian, Chair. Sorry if I missed it. I might have been distracted for a second. The freight rail issues, are the passenger rail impacts, Amtrak and North Star?
Yes. Yeah, one of the issues was passenger service. Even though we only have one train a day in each direction, the Amtrak Empire Builder, one of the downsides of rail congestion was that Amtrak went from an 80% on-time record from 2013 down to a 30% on-time record. And for eastbound trains coming into St. Paul, for almost 6 months, the average arrival time was 4 to 8 hours late in St. Paul at Union Depot. Again, because of rail congestion. A very major impact. Thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you.
Again, the Bakken. Large-scale drilling of the formation began in 2005. 1 million barrels a day was reached in May of 2014. In December of 2014, there was actually a 20% increase from that threshold mark. We're now at 1.2 million barrels per day. We're expecting, and this was written before we saw the cataclysmic drop in oil prices, we expected that if it continued at $100 a barrel and oil production continuing as fast as they could possibly drill and develop the field, for that to double to over 2 million barrels per day by 2023. Now with the price of oil dropping to below $40 a barrel, we think we'll have a twofold impact. One is that the growth of the field and further development will be delayed. We see that by a drop in the number of oil rigs. We dropped from 200 oil rigs to 150 just over the last 4 weeks. We see over 600 wells now that have not been hydraulically fractured to bring them on stream but put in reserve for the future. So the well has been drilled, but it hasn't been opened up. And all that's because of low oil prices. That said, the wells that are currently pumping oil have been paid for, are totally profitable, and cannot be shut down for technical reasons. If you shut down a high-pressure, deep shale oil well, it tends not to restart. And so they don't have the luxury of just turning it off and turning it back on. So the million barrels a day that we see today, until those wells start slowing down, will continue for the foreseeable future, the next year to 2 years. And our number of oil trains and our demand for pipelines in the short term will continue unabated in pretty much at current levels. Loading terminals started in 2009 for rail when they ran out of available pipeline space in the field. There are now 18 terminals in the Bakken, each capable of loading one to two full train loads a day. So the capacity to move oil out of the field is pretty much unlimited. It's just the rail capacity on the through routes that is blocking traffic. Today we're seeing 10 trains a day coming out of the Bakken, going in all directions. Six of those trains are coming through the Twin Cities. Seven are going through Minnesota, including those going down the western side of the state headed for the Gulf Coast. In any regard, we see at least a 40-year life to this oil field. The Bakken field is the second largest proven oil deposit in the history of the U.S., exceeded only by the Alaskan North Slope and the Permian Basin in Texas. So this is not a small play of oil. This is something major in our history. And it is only one-fourth developed. 15,000 wells have been drilled out of a possible 60,000 wells that are projected to be drilled. So the future of this field, whether we grow it in the immediate term or wait for it to develop when oil prices go back up, will be a factor for a long time to come. There's just some pictures of what's going on in the oil field. Loading facilities, they're set up for unit trains, obviously without uncoupling the cars. The oil fields that are out there, you would expect to, with this many wells being drilled, you might see a forest of rigs like you did in the old Texas fields if you look back at the 30s and 40s and look at those pictures. In actuality, these oil rigs are spaced 4 miles apart on a perfect grid, and each one of these oil rigs can drill as many as 30 wells in all directions from one pad because they go down 2 miles and then go out horizontally 2 miles with an accuracy of plus or minus 3 feet of where they need to be in the seam of oil. Technology is just mind-boggling. The other effect out there is road traffic and trucks to collect the oil and to deliver the sand and the oil field pipe and everything else is destroying North Dakota roads. There are thousands of trucks running every day, and it's like Madison Square Garden on a game night, day and night out there all the time. If you've been through Williston in the last 2 years, you know what I'm talking about. The other issue is what happens with this Bakken crude oil. Like I mentioned, it's a light sweet crude. The volatility is about on par with gasoline. In some ways, it's worse than gasoline because coming out of the well, it contains natural gas liquids like butane and propane. If you look at the liquid that's in your butane lighter, that is pressurized in that lighter to about 25 to 45 PSI. So when you flick your Bic, it turns to gas and comes through the wick and sustains the flame. So you're carrying a miniature bomb in your pocket all the time, except that plastic is not going to melt or explode. But each one of these rail cars has a certain percentage, 5 to 15% of butane and propane in the mix of crude oil that if it's released due to a rupture, is pressurized beyond natural atmospheric pressure, turns to gas almost immediately and becomes an ignition threat. And that's why we've seen fires like Lamaganti in Quebec in July 2013 where 60 out of 70 rail cars were derailed, 40 of them ruptured. The resulting fire, which happened almost instantaneously on a Monday morning, incinerated 47 people. Some of the bodies have never been found. The fire is not an explosion, but it is a fire, and it has an evacuation radius and an impact zone of half a mile from the fire because that's how hot it burns. On the upper left-hand side, you see Castleton, the fire that happened out there. Luckily, it happened outside of Castleton and not in Fargo and Moorhead. But again, the fireball, nobody needed to be evacuated, although they were ready to evacuate the village of Castleton. They allowed it to burn out over 6 hours. But again, this just illustrates the nature of the commodity. The bottom left-hand side is a trainload of Bakken that was hit by a heavy commercial vehicle at a grade crossing in Canada. There was a small fire. Only one or two cars were breached. And you can see the scorch marks on the upper side of the picture. But this is what can happen at a grade crossing when a heavy commercial vehicle weighing 40 tons either is impacted by the train or impacts the train. A derailment is highly likely, and that's one of the targets we were aiming at with the grade crossing safety study. And then, again, some of these cars being ruptured and going into nearby bodies of water, lakes and rivers. The PCA is very concerned about this. One of the actions that you took with legislation last year was to fund PCA preparatory activities and get the railroads to prepare emergency preparedness plans. But this is just something that, again, has happened all over the country. It's happened in Virginia. It's happened in Mobile. It's happened in Canada. It stands at risk of happening on the Mississippi River because on either side of the Mississippi River, those six oil trains that are coming through the Twin Cities every day are either going down the west bank or the east bank of the river until they reach La Crosse. So, again, an issue to be considered. One of the things about crude by rail, why we have it, is that there's only enough pipeline capacity in the Bakken to handle about 350,000 barrels per day of the million or more barrels per day being produced. Plus, the rail flexibility, when a rail shipper goes and says to a railroad, I want to ship this, they can put it on a railroad train and literally ship it to either coast, either the three coasts, or any place in the U.S. to a refinery customer. That is something they can't do with the pipeline network. Even after a pipeline network is built out in the future, they won't have that flexibility. And so there's a certain demand for that rail flexibility. The railroads cost 50% more than shipping it by pipeline, but that flexibility is worth a premium price to some refineries that have been out of business for lack of good feedstock for years. Tank car designs, should mention that. The current lot of general-purpose tank cars carrying Bakken crude are called DOT 111s. They are 1960s designs. They have a 7/16-inch steel shell. No particular protection. Pressure relief valves that are not made to handle high pressures and temperatures and high volumes. So if you have a tank car in the middle of a fire and it starts to heat up and the liquid starts pressurizing, that pressure relief valve will release pressure, but not at the rate that it needs to prevent exploding the car, literally rupturing the tank itself. The federal government went into rulemaking 4 years after the railroad industry passed new regulations for safer tank cars, but the federal government did not act. Last year they did rulemaking that brought them up to a 1232 plus is the terminology. Rail car that's actually safer than what the railroads adopted for a new design tank car in 2011. That new tank car safety standard and new operating rules for Bakken crude and unit trains is supposed to be released tomorrow, January 15th. That was one of the regulations passed in the Cromnibus Act in December. So we're looking forward to seeing what that does. We may be in a situation that where we can repeat that federal regulation in state regulation and put us in a position of actually inspecting those rail cars in the state of Minnesota as well as other places. Track capacity, rail operations, emergency response are all being handled in federal rulemaking, but also in state law, and all of those will be increases in safety. That said, new tank car designs and a lot of the activities that we're putting in place, like grade crossing safety improvements, grade separations, new pipeline capacity, nothing is going to happen in less than 3 years. So we have a window of vulnerability in the near term that just is almost physically impossible to ignore.
Mr. Christensen,
Just wanted to understand a little better something you just said about state regs as they relate to tank cars.
Mm-hmm.
Did I misunderstand that state regs can mirror federal regs?
Yes, we do that currently with hazardous materials regulations, for instance, okay. For commercial motor vehicles. We basically do a ditto in state law for the federal regulations. It is somewhat difficult to impose stricter regulations on federally regulated activities, but we can recreate those in state law, and then that allows our state inspectors and our state enforcement officials and the like to directly deal with any violations we see.
So can we expect to see something emerge that this committee will consider yet this year?
That is being considered.
Okay. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, relating to that question, what about, you mentioned state inspectors, does it subject the rail companies to two sets of inspections, or does the federal government delegate that to our state and we enforce whatever our state policies were, if they were less restrictive or equal? How does that work? Are we setting it up for more regulations in the sense of two inspections versus one?
Mr. Christensen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, an excellent question. What we do with the federal regulatory agencies, especially the FRA on safety, is that we work in cooperation with them. We have a state cooperative agreement where our state inspectors operate essentially as in the shoes of federal inspectors. So even though we have eight federal inspectors normally assigned to the state of Minnesota currently and concentrating on crude oil routes in five different disciplines, we have two disciplines covered with our three state inspectors and possibly soon to be four, operating in concert with FRA regulations. When it comes to notices of violation and enforcement, we can file notices with the railroads and shippers, and we can file that notice. In fact, we automatically file a notice with the FRA. If there is need for enforcement activity, up to and including shutting down railroad operations, the FRA will do that based on our evaluation and notifications.
So in other words, similar to our environmental inspectors that the PCA has in some arenas.
Correct.
The state inspectors have what we would call delegated authority from the FRA.
Absolutely.
Is that accurate? Okay, thank you.
The other things we're looking at, of course, our state activities with the grade crossing study, hazmat inspections, track inspections. DPS has taken on, in concert with the railroads, more emergency response training. Make sure every community along the crude oil rail routes knows that there's crude oil running through their community and that they're offered a chance for free training by the railroads of those emergency responders. That said, we cannot force those local agencies to respond in some cases because of budgetary constraints or the nature of their volunteer staff. In a few cases, they've refused that training for lack of ability. But for the most part, we've basically doubled the number of emergency units along the rail routes that are now capable of responding to emergency actions having to do with crude by rail. Federal actions, I mentioned tank car rules, inspections, new standards for operations. And the railroads, of course, have increased their own inspections. We have parts of the Staples Sub, for instance, the main line from St. Cloud, from Fargo through St. Cloud to the Twin Cities, where they are inspecting track literally once a week with their own inspectors, and then our state inspectors and federal inspectors providing oversight and verification of what they're doing, as well as their own independent inspections. They're expanding capacity, again, to look at these service issues that I talked about that are impacting the state in a negative manner. And there's other actions taking place, such as North Dakota Industrial Commission's requirement now that as of April of this coming year, that all oil produced for shipment in railroads or in pipelines be stabilized. That is, the butanes and propanes are removed from the barrel, and the flash point of the product and the vapor pressure of that product is no worse than a finished product such as gasoline or diesel, and is not pressurized at an above atmospheric level when it's being hauled in carriage. So if there's a rupture, there isn't an automatic vaporization of the product once these light ends have been stripped off. And, of course, pipeline expansion, which is a whole other game we won't talk about today. The crude by rail grade crossing study, specifically we looked at 700 miles of track that we're carrying crude oil on, Canadian Pacific Railroad, BNSF main lines. 683 crossings were involved in evaluation, and our goal was to look at preventing derailments having to do with grade crossing collisions, accidents. We identified the impact zones around each of those potential collision points and the risk to residents, in particular in those areas. And we concentrated on that risk interaction. Conventional railroad grade crossing safety just tries to reduce the chances of a vehicle to train collision. We looked beyond that. We looked at the risk to people within a half-mile radius, both in a buffer along the rail line and around the grade crossing area, that would be at risk if there was a catastrophic incident, and particularly in areas where there was heavy commercial truck routes. The methodology we looked at, we inventoried all crossings on these crude oil routes. We looked at all safety installations for adequacy and whether they could be improved. We developed scoring based on population areas and facilities, locations of schools, hospitals, prisons, emergency responders such as police and fire departments. We mapped all of that. We did new traffic counts on the 40 highest risk crossings, so we had good numbers for vehicle counts and heavy commercial vehicles, which in many cases were lacking. And then we conducted outreach to the railroads and to the communities and through the governor's 10 safety roundtables that he did around the state through the summer and fall. The governor is very much involved in this. A lot of the input that we got that led us to some of our conclusions, and in particular the grade separation initiative that came out of this crossing study, came from those roundtables, because we not only heard that emergency responders were concerned about safety in a catastrophic incident, they were also concerned about the risk and safety of having their communities blocked by a stop train or a derailed train, or for that matter, just by slow trains and congestion on the main lines. We did a risk analysis in December, a risk management analysis headed up by our chief of staff, and we determined that the risk of a daily delay for emergency response and normal community circulation is equal to the incidental once-in-a-thousand risk of a catastrophic event. And so that led us to definite conclusions about not only preventing accidents at grade crossings, but also looking at emergency response routes and circulation, which in turn led us to look at grade separations at key locations where they'd be most beneficial. Our recommendations included the $2 million appropriation that the legislature gave us last year. We identified 10 low-cost projects, nine of which are grade crossing safety improvements. At grade crossing safety improvements, again, everything from closures to improved gates and lights at a crossing to medians to interlocks with existing traffic signals that could divert traffic away from the crossing. We looked at medium and long-term at grade crossing improvements. We quantified what that might look like in terms of cost for us to do those improvements. About $5 million, roughly, rough approximation, for medium term from 2 to 5 years out, and another $10 million for beyond 10 years to continue improvements at lower risk crossings. And that is a very fluid number, because as a railroad, for instance, does double tracking and improves capacity on a rail line, they may be in a position through their projects to pick up some of the costs of these. In other areas, the railroad may not be improving their capacity, and the local road authority will be the primary respondent for doing that safety improvement. So it'll be a case of how much at the state level do we assist that. The grade separation program that I looked at identified three major grade crossings that are pretty much shovel-ready at this point, but haven't been advanced for lack of funding. Even though there have been efforts made for federal funding and state funding, as well as railroad funding, to move these projects off-center. Those three projects total about $70 million. They're a three-grade separation project in Moorhead, Minnesota, right near downtown, 20th and 21st and Main Street. The Wilmer Y, which is an actual rail bypass that takes crude oil traffic out of downtown Wilmer and the yards and at-grade crossings, puts it out in the western agricultural area and provides a direct link for the trains to head south toward the Gulf Coast. That requires two grade separations to make that happen, a state trunk highway and a county road to the airport. We looked at three planned developed projects, but are not yet shovel-ready, and then nine other projects that, in the process of the governor's roundtable, were requested as key projects that would solve circulation and emergency response problems by communities that were on these crude oil routes. And in most cases, they were well thought out. They were doable. But, again, they haven't been taken forward for planning studies and engineering studies at this point in time. Are there any questions, Mr. Chair, on anything having to do with the background level of rail congestion and crude before we get into the economic development issues?
See, a couple of questions. Senator Dietzick, I think, had her hand up first. I'll just mention quickly, though, that these dollars identified in the recommendations are reflected in the bill that was just introduced in the bonding section. I think we fall a little bit short on the at grade. We do hit the mark on the grade separated. Part of what we seek to accomplish is asking the railroads to match those dollars on a dollar for dollar basis. We'll see if we succeed at that, but we're optimistic that we have good partners in the industry. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for letting me join you here today. As Senator Dibble mentioned, I have a lot of railroads. I have the Shoreham Yards and what I would call the southern end of Northtown Yards and the western end of the St. Paul Yards in my district. At least at one point, the Northtown Yards, Shoreham Yards, was connected to about 10,000 jobs, so it is a big economic impact in my area. The railroads are at various levels active in the community. Some of the questions, and one of them will go back to the inspectors that the state hired. Are you allowed on railroad property to do the inspections? And are you doing track inspections? And then I've gone to several of these railroad meetings that the governor has had, and then the city of Minneapolis actually had one, and various people and a lot of the fire people that are here today and the railroads were at that meeting. One of the things that came up is I have 35 railroad bridges in my district. And so as you talk about these at-grade crossings that are going to cost and they're needed, Coon Rapids can tell you about how they block traffic and the fire departments can't get there. City of Ramsey had a fire in the city, and luckily they had a agreement with Monticello or somebody else because they never made it to the fire. They were they don't like being the last one to show up at a fire in their community, but luckily another community showed up, so that was helpful. But that'll cost money, and they're needed, but who's going to maintain them? And then, again, we have the issues of how much they cost and who's maintaining the bridges that we have now, because from what I've heard from my local communities is that the local municipalities will inspect the bridges from underneath, but they're not allowed on the railroad property. And I understand some of that is for safety reasons. And so just kind of what agreement do you have with the railroads and what to expect and inspect, and do you have access to their property?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's a number of questions in there. I'll try to kind of hit them one by one. Yes, our inspectors do, as well as the federal inspectors, have access to the property of the railroads. That's authorized under federal law, and our state inspectors are certified under a federal program. Usually those visits are announced. Sometimes they're unannounced, depending upon the purpose of the visit. We have two track inspectors, so they are conducting track inspections, of course, looking at the integrity and condition of the rail, both in yards and along mainline track and other types of track. We have a hazmat inspector, so they are checking tanker cars, they're checking seals, they're checking the status of the equipment, they're checking documentation, markings of those tanker cars, they're checking shipping papers to ensure that they properly identify the location of those hazmat cars within a train, overall train. Set of cars. So they're checking for a variety of things. On the bridge issue, most of the railroad bridges are owned by the railroads themselves. There are a relatively small number of bridges that are owned by public road authorities, including city, county, and some state-owned bridges that railroads use. According to federal law, those bridges, it's up to the carrier, the railroad, to determine whether or not that bridge is safe to cross for the train. In other words, that's not a public responsibility per se. And the public road authorities do inspect for the underneath of those bridges. And there is coordination. There's sharing of the inspection reports generally, certainly with MnDOT's bridge office who does those inspections. We contact the railroads and we share our reports and we receive some of their reports. There is evolving federal regulation on the issue of bridge safety, railroad bridge safety. Federal inspectors do not currently inspect bridges per se. What they do is they review the bridge inspection programs and certain requirements for those inspection programs of the railroads themselves. They will respond to complaints and actually inspect problem bridges, but not as a regular discipline under the overall inspection program. We're expecting some tougher regulations and more inspection requirements to be coming out to be proposed as regulation at the federal level in the next year or two.
So, Mr. Gardner, I know that on the subject of inspections, one of the elements to be analyzed is state inspection activities and staffing levels. I did see in the summary some recitation of kind of where we had one inspector and we increased our complement to three and maybe we're going to get to four. But is there analysis of the role of inspections in this study and or our goal to improve safety in the state along the lines of what you just mentioned? We have new more stringent regs coming down the pike that we need to be paying closer attention to.
Mr. Chair, the focus of the grade crossing safety study really was on infrastructure improvements, not on the inspection program per se, but we are certainly looking at our current staffing and our current capacity, the disciplines that we cover. We're in a continuous conversation with the Federal Railroad Administration, had an extensive meeting this morning to talk about how they are staffing up and where any gaps might be within our state. We're also concerned about the staffing, frankly, and inspection levels in our border states because, for example, with crude oil routes, that crude obviously is being loaded in North Dakota. And currently, the state of North Dakota does not have an inspection program. They do not have rail inspectors. And so we are seeing some level of problems on those trains coming out, which really are not railroad issues. Those rail cars are made available by the shippers, but the shippers are not doing proper securement and loading in some cases. That needs to occur at the point of origin in North Dakota with North Dakota rail inspectors or federal rail inspectors.
Can you say that again? North Dakota has no rail inspectors.
They're currently considering it in their legislative session currently. That's correct.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting.
I could clarify. They do have federal rail inspectors. Uh-huh. They do not have the state program like we do.
Okay. So do they have federal rail inspectors detailed to the state? I mean, are they on
yes.
the ground in place?
Out of the Seattle district, yes.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Let's continue to have that conversation. Mr. Gardner and Mr. Christensen, because I do see that one of the elements, the fifth point, is to analyze state inspection activities and staffing for track and hazardous materials. So I need to get to that at some point. Senator Disick, were you finished?
I can be.
Okay, Senator Westrom.
Yeah, no, Senator Westrom.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I don't want to cut you off. If you've got a question, you feel free to ask. Mr. Chair, a couple questions. Interesting. Start with the question I asked earlier, and then your recent comments about North Dakota and that they have federal inspectors, not state inspectors. So I understand better. If we didn't have state inspectors, would the federal government just cover it then, or do we have multiple more inspectors because we as a state pay for some of it and the federal government does what they do here and what they do in North Dakota, or are they doing more in North Dakota because they don't have a state inspector?
Mr. Gard.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's really up to each state whether they decide to hire rail inspectors and participate in this federal program. The Federal Rail Administration allocates their inspectors based on their identified needs and their resources, frankly. So states that have added their own inspectors essentially supplement the federal rail inspectors to create a broader force of inspection. The Federal Railroad Administration does not necessarily have the capacity, the budget, to fill that gap, as it were.
And it's important to mention that the railroad industry is sharing in the cost of the state inspectors. That's something we established last year.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, to give you a perspective on how much there are about 600 operating employees at the FRA. About 60 to 70 of those are employed in track inspection as oversight, the cops on the beat. That's literally not much more than one per state, and those are concentrated in states with heavy traffic like Illinois, Chicago area, New York, Los Angeles. In the state of Minnesota, it's important to note that of the two disciplines that we have covered in our inspection programs, the FRA, prior to last year, only had a part-time track inspector for the state of Minnesota. We did have a full-time track inspector. As crude oil ramped up and became more important, and as we increased our program, we now have two full-time track inspectors from the federal government in the state and two full-time state inspectors. The same with hazardous material. They've assigned one person to the state of Minnesota, and we have one person. So our complementary program has essentially doubled the oversight that we have here.
Okay. Question, going back to the rail, the miles of rail we had in 1970, early in your report, and today, I'll kind of weave a few things into this and just let you respond. But so has rail traffic dropped that much since 1970 that we just could get rid of that many rails? Are we looking at... Are you seeing more rail being discussed to put back down in some of the corridors we took up 15, 20 years ago? Are they just that much more efficient so they could run the same number or more rail cars and trains on half the number of rails and it's become a more efficient system? Can you just explain that a little bit more to us? And I'm also thinking of this as my farmers are paying the premium for having their grain moved because of the rail car shortage that we've seen in the last year especially. And so just your thoughts and comments on that and where are we at? Are we just down that much in rail car traffic that it made sense to pull all those rails out 15, 20 years ago? And where are we at on that front? If you could, it'd just be insightful.
Mr. Chair, Senator. In 1980, when deregulation was passed and we had over 9,000 miles of track in the state, a lot of that was duplicative trackage. For instance, we had, through southeast Minnesota, we had five different main lines running north and south, five different railroads. We had four railroads running between the Twin Cities and Duluth Superior. We had four railroads running east and west across from Twin Cities into the Dakotas. By mergers and tearing up trackage that was not needed, although the rail traffic itself was just concentrated on fewer lines, the railroad saved a tremendous amount of money. But we're now down to one main line between the Twin Cities and Duluth. Can't get any lower than that. We have basically two main lines across southeast Minnesota, north-south in Iowa, and two main lines going into the Dakotas. A huge difference in the amount of track. And most branch lines have been abandoned, where they were only carrying a few carloads a week into a given town. That said, the efficiencies of concentrating more traffic on less track, and there's not been a reduction in traffic, it's just a steady increase, it has led to things like the shuttle grain trains, which allows us to get to the Pacific Northwest as cheap as by barge down the Mississippi. And to export markets. We weren't able to do that before via rail. That shuttle train activity also was concentrated on the fact that the co-ops and the farmers had to agree to build shuttle elevators that could load not one car or 10 cars, but 100 cars at a time. This was the shuttle elevator phenomenon, which now handle 70% of all the grain traffic in Minnesota and Dakotas and Iowa and the like. The average farmer before 2000 had a three-axle truck and drove his grain 7 miles to the local elevator. The average farmer now farms a lot more acres, owns several full semis with 40-foot vans on back, capable of carrying 25 tons at a crack, and the average haul is 70 miles. That 70 to 100 miles is a collection radius for ethanol plants and for shuttle grain elevators, as well as for a lot of mills and oil, soybean oil plants, canola plants, things of that sort. The farmers consider it much more flexible, and they're willing to trade off their cost of trucking a longer distance with their own trucks, with them as the driver, in exchange for having a significantly lower rail rate. Like I said, the difference between a carload rate and a shuttle train rate on average is 30% reduction per ton of grain moved, and that makes them competitive in the world market. If they had to operate in the old system under one carload at a time in a local elevator, our agricultural business would not be dealing in the export market today. So that's just some of the facts of the matter. That said, the service failures that we had last year and the requirement for more cars than what were out there were because the shuttle trains were operating slower. They couldn't handle as much grain because of that. And all of a sudden you had people doing the only thing they could think of, and that was hire more cars and put more cars on the railroad in carload lots, anything to get their grain to market, because it just wasn't getting there. And that's the service problem that we talked to the STB about. We had hearings in the field and in Washington. The governor weighed in. Our congressional delegation weighed in. Many of you took part in letters to the STB. And the pressure was put on the railroads to try and improve that performance. That said, the long-range solution for that performance is them to invest in, which they're doing now, and increasing that track capacity. For instance, on the BNSF, most of the track from Twin Cities to North Dakota is single-track line. Within 3 years, that will almost all be double-tracked. The track down the Mississippi River, the old Milwaukee Road line, which is now Canadian Pacific, was always double-tracked up until the mid-1970s. When deregulation came, they tore up one track, slowed down the trains, and designed the railroad to operate at the capacity they were seeing at the time. There are plans now to start to double track that line and increase the capacity again so we can handle more trains. And there are proposals, as there have already been in Wisconsin, of taking abandoned lines and trails and reconverting them back into active rail lines. So there's a lot of things working to start to rebuild the railroad system. I don't know a railroader today that if you talk to him privately would say, we tore up too much. They'll all agree to that, and they wish they had a lot of their rails back. Same thing with the railroad yards. Northtown Yard is being expanded. Midway Yard for the Union Pacific and South St. Paul Yard for the Union Pacific and on CP Pig's Eye Yard in St. Paul are all being expanded by significant amounts, in some cases doubled in size, because they need storage and throughput capacity.
The CN share, the St. Paul Yard?
CN is improving their trackage through their main area, the Iron Range, and from International Falls to Duluth. They're double-tracking a lot of that line, especially through Duluth, and increasing the size of their yards into Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Real briefly on the double track, can most corridors handle a double, or you said in some cases triple track, where you've got two sets of two tracks, and is that typically for trains to go one this way and one that way, or are they usually going the same way? Just do most corridors handle that kind of, or is it some do, some don't?
Mr. Chair, right away
with Senator. Right away with. I mean, do we have that capacity in most right of ways where they can do two sets of tracks?
Yeah, most right of ways in the state are 110 feet wide. They can handle double track construction on their existing right of way. We're seeing some problems with that in a few areas where the right-of-way is narrower, such as in Big Lake, where BNSF is trying to build a new track with 23-foot distance from center to center of the track. That allows them to run one track in full operation and still do maintenance on the other track. The state standard, which is 14 feet, track center, does not allow them to do active maintenance without taking both lines down. That said, most double tracks operate in both directions. And the capacity for a well-designed double-track operation with good signaling and passing sidings is about 100 trains a day. A single-track line has a design capacity, rule of thumb, 40 trains a day. Said the single-track BNSF line has been handling 60 to 70 trains a day ever since they single-tracked it. And it's been a bottleneck forever. So very much in need of doing what they're doing now.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. We don't have to dwell too far into it. It's a question I think I should be able to answer. But do railroads going through communities pay real property and personal property tax on their local investments to those local communities? And then as a follow-up, is it presumed, at least as we do these crossing improvements, that the local community would put some amount of cost share into those improvements?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the first question, the railroads pay a significant amount of property tax. There are many small communities that have that as a major share of their revenue stream.
Okay.
So if there is any change in property tax that is shared with locals, there will be okay. a benefit there. In terms of, what was your second question again?
Cost share on grade crossing improvements.
The conventional like cost sharing is that the local road authority normally would pay 100% of the crossing. If it's a grade separation or a closure, the railroads would normally kick in 5% by federal law, no more than 10%. That said, the railroads, when they propose an improvement, they usually request 10% local share for them to move ahead. In a lot of our state crossing improvement programs now, with federal funds we disperse for specific site improvements, we've waived that 10% now, and we basically pay 100% of the federal funds if there's a grade crossing improvement that we can do on across the state that we've deemed necessary for safety reasons.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Christensen, was any of the problem with the trains initially a lack of locomotives?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Christensen, Senator.
Locomotives.
Yes. In short, the short answer, the number of locomotives and train crews was tied to the velocity the railroad was running, the average train speeds. And because the traffic was increasing, they would buy locomotives and hire new employees on the basis of their immediate need. Only one railroad has operated opposite to that during the recession. That was the Union Pacific. They kept surplus crews on payroll and trained and certified, as well as extra locomotives and mothballs in case of an emergency need. They were able to respond during this last winter. The other railroads, CNCP and BNSF, were caught with only the amount of equipment that they could run at during normal times. When the need came for more locomotives and more crews, especially during last winter's severe weather, they were not able to respond to that because they literally didn't have the equipment or the crews.
All right. And, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Christensen, good to see you again. My district is highly impacted by the railroad. Cuts right through, and we're also sandwiched by Highway 10 and the river. And so with major trunk highways going through, it's a big issue. I've noticed that whether it's grade crossings or economic development, we're in your report. So the good news, we're in your report. Challenging thing is that one of the questions that I have here, though, is Burlington North is looking at using their eminent domain to take more than 150 feet. One of the things that I was interested in when you talked about the fact that they generally, the double tracks, 150 feet, is what would more footage accomplish for a railroad that there would be safety issue or something else? Could you maybe explain that a little bit as to why that would be not sufficient, maybe?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator. Normally 110 feet would be sufficient, but as I mentioned, if they keep close track centers, it impacts their ability to maintain one track and still keep the other one in operation. They have to idle both tracks when there's a track crew out there. In the case of Big Lake and some of the communities along there where they initially had land companies proposing eminent domain and takings and proposed a potential cost that they were willing to pay for that, BNSF has come back in a report to the governor in response to the last roundtable and to us, and noted that in the case of Big Lake, in some communities, the impact was overestimated. They've retracted some of those offers. And they consider that dollar amount was offered as only a starting point in negotiations. So they have softened their position, obviously, in response to public criticism. That said, we need to keep their feet to the fires at the same time, realizing that in a few cases, their right of way and the location of adjacent businesses and sidings and the like may still require them to take some property if they want to have the most efficient use of their right of way. Now, in a case like Big Lake, they've actually said that they're willing to reduce the track centers only through Big Lake itself to 14 feet and create a partial bottleneck during maintenance season in return for not having to take a lot of the property in the city. So they're handling it several different ways. The right of eminent domain, just as we do in government now with our highway programs and everything else, they are very hesitant in using it because of the backlash, even though they have that power. And so they're trying to find ways around that. So we're in the midst of negotiations with them and keeping track of what's going on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but I do think that especially it was very sudden, and I understand and appreciate the circumstances that were there, but it really would have decimated our downtown and in a way that would have been sudden businesses or made it impossible for them to operate. So this is a matter of great concern to my district, and I was very glad to hear that they did pull back from that, though I know that our city leadership and county leadership is always interested in working together. We all care about public safety. That's an issue as well, and Big Lake has invested in the county quite a bit of money already in wide zone safety crossing. So they've demonstrated that, but I'm glad to hear that there is that willingness to reconsider that. But whenever you have a compressed area like this, it is always a challenge. And I appreciate your efforts and your work to support our safety and also to not end up with a situation where you've basically destroyed the economic vitality of a city.
Looks like Mr. Sweeney is anxious to respond to this point. I was going to ask the public to, if they wanted to speak when we're done with hearing from MnDOT. So if you can just keep your comment confined to this matter of concern to Senator Kiffmeyer, I'd appreciate it. And then you can say whatever you want in just a few minutes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator, I need to clarify this last item. I don't believe we ever at any time implied the use
please state your name for the record.
I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company. We sent letters to property owners indicating that their property may be involved in the project, offering to pay for a right of entry so that we could do surveys, and then also gave an initial price offer in case we needed to purchase the property. We asked for an option. This was because of a couple things, the maintenance issue with the federal regulation, but also MnDOT raised a concern about the proximity of Highway 10 to the tracks, and that was what drove it. Shortly after Christmas, it became obvious that that property would not be needed, and the city was notified of that.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Sweeney. Being aware of that, I do appreciate that, but even getting such a letter quite a concern, but appreciate your willingness to take a look at those things, and I certainly understand your business decision as my businesses did theirs as well. But thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, briefly on what the comment earlier was about the overpasses or the bridges, and maybe we could follow up after this, but the community at Glenwood has a proposal out there that Representative Anderson and I have brought forth, but either a bridge over the railroad or looking at a railroad bridge over the road to not have that four-way, two-state highway intersection always impacted like it is. I'm interested in one of your comments where you said some communities or in some cases.
All right.
Construction. In some cases, the state owns the bridge that goes over the road, but then the railroads are responsible for inspecting and maintaining it or something like that. Can you give me some of those examples, and why have those examples been reached where instead of the railroad building the bridge over the road? And maybe a brief answer now, I'd be happy to follow up or have you check back with me, because I'd like to talk to you further about this.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. Typically those examples where there's public ownership of railroad bridges occurs when the road authority has a construction project or a reconstruction project. They might be widening the roadway and so forth. So as part of that construction effort, there is often a need to reconstruct that railroad bridge. And so that really is a road authority responsibility because it's driven by the construction project. So typically in those agreements, at least in the past, the public entities have maintained control of some ownership of some of those bridges. However, as I mentioned, and from the regulatory standpoint, in terms of ongoing maintenance inspection, it's kind of a split responsibility at this point.
Thank you.
There's 15 minutes left. I just don't think this seemed to be so interesting. The subject of the grade separation and the crude safety issues, that maybe we can get to Fred at a future hearing, because I love the Fred report and think it's really interesting and would like to once again visit it. But I did want to give members any other opportunities to ask questions and or ask the public forward to be heard if they had anything they wanted to articulate and weigh in on this subject as well. All right, great. Well, do you want to just touch on the Fred report a little bit,
and we'll
dive into it in more detail, perhaps if we have some legislative initiatives that arise from that in this coming session.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In 2013, the legislature mandated Minnesota DOT and DEED to do a joint study looking at freight rail economic development. That was to look at opportunities for industries within the state of Minnesota to use expanded local rail access to build jobs and improve their business competitiveness. We looked at what industries were already out there that depend upon rail service, of course, iron ore. We are number one raw ore shipper in the U.S., in Minnesota. We're the second largest shipper of agricultural products and the third largest shipper of finished food products by rail. So the railroad in those industries is very important. It's also key in things like energy, ethanol production, manufacturing, lumber, and containers. There's rail development happening all over the country. Just last year, CSX Railroad, which handles a lot of the northeast and southeast of the country, had 107 new economic development projects developed along their rail lines, each one of those representing one or more businesses that are major employers and depend upon rail access to be competitive. There's cargo-oriented development all over the country. And there's potential investment that we identified in the FRED program and in other state rail plan updates, which is going on right now in places like Big Lake, Albert Lea, Lakeville, which I mentioned, Winthrop, Asante, places all over the state. This map just shows some of the major cities that have one or more Class 1 railroads involved with the city in economic development programs, city or state. Memphis is in particular is highlighted because there are four new container yards, four Class 1 railroads, and five industrial parks that are rail-served in that area, all driving economic development in that city. Major impact. Columbus is another one. New Orleans and Baton Rouge is the third. It was used as a case study in a Ford Foundation report that pointed out the opportunities there. The findings are that rail investments support communities, job retention and creation. The short lines play a big part in that. We need to collaborate as DEED and MnDOT and the state with shippers and communities more and push economic development programs with economic development agencies. DEED has gone a long ways toward that in helping with their real estate inventory and register to provide EDAs with rail adjacent or oriented properties that they can sell for commercial development. And I think
we'll leave it there, except to say that we have several items that came out of that study. One, an identified need for more collaboration and possible programs that would help initiate that rail development. We've used some of our Mercy program, our revolving loan fund, in places like Big Lake and Winthrop to help develop rail shippers. Winthrop is a poster child for this happening because they have three new industries there, including an ethanol plant and a fertilizer plant, on the Minnesota Prairie Line, a public-owned short line that has been developed with state grants and funds and loans that would not be there. The city would not have any of these employers in place were it not for these programs. And that's just one example of what can happen with coordinated help. The other thing is in our FRED program, we developed a Rail Shippers 101 toolkit. Wisconsin has such a toolkit. Iowa has such a toolkit as does South Dakota. We built on their efforts, and we laid out a program that is being tested now in Lakeville where we go in and we tell a prospective shipper what their costs are, what they need to do, how to negotiate with the railroad. We at MnDOT feel that there is a public responsibility for us, for instance, to keep the railroads responsible for their common carrier responsibilities. And respond to the need, whereas in Lakeville, CP came to the flour mill there in town, which wanted to double their capacity, and said, we can't put any more switch engines or crews in there. We can't handle any more cars. They're already handling cars there. There is no reason that the flour mill could not go in there, say to the railroad, here are 50 more cars. You have to ship them. The flour mill backed off and let the railroad tell them that they couldn't handle the traffic. For no good reason, at least under legislated responsibilities, our toolkit that we're working with the city council down there on, we're pointing out that should not be a factor. And we as a state have already gone to the STB for some of our propane shippers and other shippers around the state to help present their case for mediation in front of the STB. If we were to follow that up, there may be a chance we could use the Attorney General's office and our legal authorities and like to help shippers in the state. We try to cooperate with the railroads, but there's also a public need to make sure that the railroads do their duty. And in that case, that's one of the things we're doing. So we have a huge opportunity in the state for large employers to be located on rail sidings where they can be presented with a competitive market outlook to the rest of the country and the world. If only they can get good rail service and cheap rail service, which is less of a problem than just a service period, and help the locals develop these for job creation. So that was what the FRED report was all about. Deed found the same activities and did their own activities to help present and build this, and again, the study points out specific strategies for improving this part of our economy.
Great. Thank you. Questions, members? No? Okay. I'd like to once again open up the opportunity for the public to step forward and be heard if they so desire. Anyone would like to address the committee? Seeing none. Okay, members, next Monday.
Couldn't miss the opportunity.
Thank you. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer. Excuse me. And I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association here in Minnesota. It's mainly the short line railroads. When you heard the reference to short lines, that's the smaller railroads. We call them class 2s and 3s that operate over a short distance. And one of the incentives, if I may just very quickly, on the FRED report, one of the incentives for the FRED report was the belief that short line railroads could become economic development tools. Along those lines are opportunities for business growth and development. One of the things these gentlemen, along with their consultants, tried to do was enhance the thinking over a deed about the fact that there are rail lines that run through these communities. And when businesses come to town and want to find or come to the state and are looking for a place to locate, coming to deed hopefully would direct them to some of these communities. Just this morning, for your reference, and I know we're talking a lot about rural Minnesota in this legislative session, for good reason, most of the short lines and all of the class ones in one fashion or another run through rural Minnesota. Just this morning, I got a call from Brad Finstead, who runs the Center for Policy for Rural Policy and Development, who announced that they had just published a study called The State of Freight Rail, their key findings, and they called it Untangling the Issues. I just commend it to you for a look at it. If you want to go through it, I haven't even gone through it myself totally yet, but it talks a lot about how railroads are, as he calls them, the arteries for economic development in the state of Minnesota. And hopefully we'll be able to use this and come back and talk about this study. Mr. Chairman, these gentlemen finished this study in November of 2013. Unfortunately, in December of 2013, there was an incident in Castleton that everybody is aware of and has talked about. And this whole study kind of got set aside while we talked about safety and service. Hopefully we could come back and have some more discussion about this, more than 5 minutes, and really get into this. Because I think if we're talking rural Minnesota and job development, railroads can help you get there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Appas. Thank you for letting us know about that report, and we will grab a copy of it and distribute it to everyone through a link in your email. So, and we'll also post it on the committee website, so you can take a look at it at your leisure. And we will take these issues up. Some of these items, I mean, we did in the proposed bill that we introduced Monday, did replenish the Mercy Fund, the revolving loan fund that we use to help the smaller railroads around the state. But there's some other ideas that were articulated, touched on briefly. Some of those are going to have to come through Senator Tomasoni's committee, so we'll work with him as well on some of these ideas. Senator Wieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, briefly for the department, for the rail grade crossing rail safety report, there's reference to school crossings, and I'm wondering if you have some separate information that you could pull out. My role on E12 committee and safety concerns and funding that we're involved in and safety, I'd like to see how those recommendations would align with things that we're talking about. So I see that you've looked at it in here, but if there's additional information as it relates to school crossings, I'd appreciate that.
Timely question. We just had the tragedy in Western Minnesota, the BNSF.
And Mr. Chair and Senator, the methodology we tried to identify school bus routes. We had limited success in that in doing GIS mapping on those routes, probably because of changing routes and not having information from local school districts. We did make a lot of phone calls with limited response. That said, we did map all school locations within the half-mile buffer zones. And so we have that information on file in the report and some of the appendices. And that is a proxy for looking at where the schools are and where those routes may interact with the impact zones.
Mr. Chair, we'll follow up.
Okay. Great. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, a comment they made earlier, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding your assessment or prediction. We've seen the drop in the oil price. Last I remember, this type of war of competition going on was in the early to mid 80s. But is your assessment with the Bakken that it probably stays the same and doesn't hit that 2 million that might have been predicted if the oil prices are high? Or do you think the production, do you have reason to believe or think the production will go down quite a bit, or are we just looking at probably a status quo situation and that dictates some of the rail car and the number of trains predicted in the future? Is that where are you at on that, if you can just
Mr. Chair and Senator, speaking from my personal experience, 10 years in the oil industry, and I was a victim of that 1980 price crash. I was a good oilman until that happened. Then I ended up in the transportation business. And also we've been working with Commerce at the request of the government and through the EQB on an interagency task force on trying to project those volumes. Our best projection at this point is that we will see a market or a complete end of growth to the field, but that the current production already being pumped will not decrease except for the decrease in the existing wells. These wells tend to tail off pretty quickly. They drop by about 50% in the first year. But after that, the drop-off slows down and they continue. So we could see, if all the oil rigs stop drilling tomorrow, which isn't happening yet, we would see within a year a drop in the volume of our trains going through the state, probably from 7 or 8 a day to 4 or 5 a day, let's say 2 years out. The flip side of that is that these wells, once they're in place, the existing wells can be refracked, and the wells that are in reserve that haven't been fracked for the first time, it takes about 4 to 6 days to frack a well and a few more weeks to hook up the pipelines and bring them on stream with oil gas separators and everything else. The upside of the field is extremely flexible. And so as the oil field will probably slow down a lot slower, then it'll speed up if the prices go up to the $70 or $100 range again. So that's something we have to keep in mind. So we're being given a reprieve right now and are looking at pipelines and rail grade crossing safety. It won't get worse by our best estimation. It may get better over the short term, but it will not go away.
So real briefly, to the question. It kind of begs the pipeline issue, the Keystone Pipeline, if that gets built, Sandpiper, if that gets built, does it relieve more pressure than what we're seeing right now, or how does that affect it? Last question.
For instance, right now there's 700,000 barrels a day being shipped by rail, 700,000 to 800,000. Sandpiper would handle from 250,000 to 350,000 barrels of that, roughly take a third of the field's production. There would still be another 300,000 or 400,000 barrels per day after Sandpiper is up and running that would still be going by train. And like I said, depending on the flexibility needed by the oil producers and the refiners that they're buying from them, there could be a larger portion of that. That said, the pipelines are in it for the long run. A pipeline shipper has to subscribe for anywhere from 10 to 20 years of pipeline capacity before the pipeline would be built. So these are people looking at what's the oil industry going to do over the next 20 years, not over the next 2 years.
And Keystone is only taking Canadian.
Yep.
All right. Anything else, members?
Sure.
Senator Westrom.
On the Keystone, and maybe just so we're clear, my understanding is that's taken Canadian, but right now there's a lot of pressure on the rail picking up Canadian crude, and so the Keystone would relieve the rail pressure that's happening because of not having the Keystone, or is that myth?
Yeah, again, our long-term projections, assuming that the price was high, projected that by 2023 we could be up to 12 or 15 train loads of Bakken coming through the state, but also 4 train loads per day of tar sands crude, which is all going by pipeline today, because the tar sands was projected to grow another 1 million barrels per day over the next 7 years as well. If you look at the Bakken, there's 7.5 billion barrels, about 50 years supply of oil in that formation. The tar sands has 350 billion barrels of proven reserves, centuries worth. So the Canadians are betting on being an oil player for a long, long time.
So,
you're good.
All right. Anything further? Right. So we're not meeting Monday. We are meeting Wednesday with another informational hearing. We thought we were going to do ports and airports. Senator Reinert's not able to be here. He had a keen interest in that. So we're looking at other informational hearing subjects. If anyone has anything that they're really anxious to get to, fill out those forms that we distributed and get them to me, and just let me know that it's really really hot to trot on that particular subject, and we'll see about going over that item this coming Wednesday. Anything further, members, with that? We are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay.